Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Well, I got a fun episode for us today, Tommy.
Oh boy, fun. I like fun.
That's right. So we've already talked about negligence probably many times on this podcast, I believe.
Yes, and I have been negligent many times on this podcast, I believe.
I concur with that.
like with the sound a couple of episodes ago.
That's right. One of the secret bathtub tape recordings.
Yeah, I still haven't figured out how that happened or why. Everything looked the same as every other time, but somehow it still happened. I don't know.
I think it was operator error, but that's just my guess.
Well, I would too, but he has an excuse. He was probably drunk.
Should fire that guy.
I know. I will the next time I see him.
So what I want to do is I want to talk about, expand a little bit on the whole theory of negligence. We've talked about that at length. Now, the elements of negligence, we're going to go back to that because that's the starting block. Do you remember what they are?
The elements of negligence.
Yes.
Is it like nitrogen and hydrogen?
Well, there's four different parts. I'll give you that.
Four different parts. Oh, is that the breach, duty, damages, and cause?
That's it. Those are the four ones.
Well, you know, it took 2 years, but you finally drilled them into my thick head.
Yeah. You said them out of order because I always say duty, breach, cause, damages. And I think that's the prevailing way you kind of analyze it.
Duty.
Yep. And I always learned
it. You always rank duty first.
I always learned it in law school as DBCD. That was my
DBCD.
That was my mnemonic to remember it when I was trying to memorize it.
When I was in college, I learned ACDC.
You did you?
I was on the highway to hell.
You just stick your finger in a light socket? Is that what happened to your hair?
It was dirty deeds done dirt cheap.
So whenever you want to sue somebody for like an auto accident, those are the elements that you have to establish to maintain your cause of action for negligence.
You must have duty on their car.
They had a duty to maintain their car safely. They breached that duty and operated negligently. They caused damages to you. So those are the elements, basically. But now you can go into more. That's your basic analysis of negligence is right there. But there's more to it than just that, because when you break it down, you can actually assign blame.
I've done that all my life. I've assigned blame to others.
You have. You're excellent at it.
Yes. I rarely assign blame to myself. There's got to be somebody else responsible, just like the sound difficulty.
So everybody pull out your blame throwers, because we're about to talk about comparative versus contributory negligence.
Comparative versus contributive?
Contributory.
Blame.
Contributory negligence.
Okay.
Whenever somebody files a lawsuit, they have a complaint and they'll assert the different elements. Where basically they'll assert the elements of duty, breach, cause, damages, in addition to laying out jurisdictional requirements and things like that. Mm-hmm. So what will happen is the defendant will file what's called an answer. And in that answer,
that's a very technical term.
It is.
They filed an answer.
In that answer, they will respond to each of the different allegations which are asserted in the complaint. So it's pretty simple, right?
Yes.
Now, in addition to the answer, the defendant will also sometimes file, almost always file, what's called affirmative defenses.
Affirmative defenses. In other words, that's like the best defense is a good offense?
Kind of, yeah.
So you say, here's why it wasn't my fault, and here's why it was yours.
Exactly.
You so knucklehead.
The defendant might answer the question and say, well, we're asserting the defense that the actual auto accident was the result of the plaintiff's negligence. And that was really what caused the accident, not what we did. And that would be an affirmative defense, and that would either be a contributory or comparative negligence affirmative defense. Now,
I tried to use that before.
Did you?
Yeah, when I ran into the rear of a car. Mm-hmm. And the person just stopped in the middle of the road for no apparent reason.
Yeah.
And when I asked, why did you stop there? She said, I was trying to find a place to drive up on the sidewalk to avoid the pothole. And I felt the mere fact that she was trying to drive on the sidewalk shifted the blame to her.
I mean, I can see where it would a little bit. Yeah. It depends.
It didn't work.
Yeah.
I was still responsible because I hit her in the butt.
Well, I rear-ended somebody one time, and they had a long piece of lumber sticking out of the back of their van.
Well, you're lucky it wasn't sticking out of the front of your head.
Aw, no kidding. Final destination stuff.
Yeah, really.
But, you know, I think you can make an argument there, too, is that when you have something abnormally protruding from the end of your vehicle, that maybe it's your fault that you got hit.
But, yeah.
But I think, you know, it's not a slam dunk because you're still culpable for maintaining your own vehicle, but it shifts it a little bit and changes the percentages somewhat, I think.
Yeah, especially if you don't have one of those red flags or something tied on the rear. You know how a lot of times somebody has a piece of lumber out and they got like a flag hanging there?
Yeah, I think they did.
Because that helps as far as perspective, because sometimes it's hard to judge a perspective. How far is that sticking out of there if you don't have something else?
I think they did. I still didn't see it.
Oh. Well, now it's your fault.
Yep. So different states follow contributory negligence versus comparative negligence. They're two different basic theories, and I want to explain to you the difference between them.
Good, because I don't know. I could guess, but I don't know.
Well, okay. Go ahead and give me your guess then.
for which one?
What is comparative negligence?
Well, comparative negligence, I would say, is comparatively, between the two of you that had this accident, who was the most to blame?
Okay, and what would be contributory negligence?
Well, contributory would be, all right, well, you had a little bit to do with it, and you had a little bit to do with it. So then you kind of like say, well, you were probably 60% responsible, and you were probably 40% responsible. So I feel like that it kind of breaks it down into more of how much blame is assigned to each one, or somebody was 100% responsible. It could be, I guess.
Well, I mean, you're just wrong.
Oh, okay. Well, you know,
your first answer and your second answer are kind of the same answer, and they deal more with comparative negligence.
Oh,
you were totally wrong on what contributory negligence is.
Oh, so okay.
You kind of described comparative negligence with both answers, I think.
Oh, I see.
So contributory negligence, and there's only a few states, this is definitely the minority, they actually bar recovery with only 1% of fault by the plaintiff. So basically, if you assert affirmative defense of a contributory negligence, and you're one of these smaller states or one of these minority states that has this, and the plaintiff is 1% at fault, you are barred from recovery. If they think you did 1% of anything wrong, you're barred from recovery.
Wow.
Yeah, it's super harsh.
Yeah. So if you had anything to do with it, if you were not a law-abiding citizen driving your vehicle properly, then that's it.
Yep. So only four states in the District of Columbia recognize pure contributory negligence. So basically, if you have 1% at fault, then you don't recover anything at all. So it's very, very draconian. So it's DC, Alabama, Maryland, North Carolina, and Virginia.
So don't drive in those states.
Yeah, or if you do, be careful. So it's those states are actually kind of, you know, blocked right there together a little bit, except Alabama, they're down there on their own.
Alabama's an outlier.
They are. So basically, just as an example, as I said, 1% is enough. So if a plaintiff is 10% at fault for causing the accident, they get nothing, even though the defendant is 90% at fault. So if you think about it, it doesn't seem very fair, does it?
No. And I've always heard these things like, if you don't have insurance and you're required to have insurance, or your driver's license was suspended or whatever, it doesn't matter if the other person just ran into you, you're at fault.
Yeah. Well, there are certain circumstances where you can overcome contributory negligence, but basically the plaintiff has to prove that the defendant's willful and wanton acts cause the injury. Then the defendant basically can't claim contributory negligence bars it from recovery. So if it's like an intentional tort, or if you ram them on purpose, like you say, well, I hit them because I was trying to kill them or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if the person, you can prove they didn't do something perfectly, then you can't use that as a bar to recovery.
I saw one of those yesterday on a YouTube clip.
Did you really?
Yeah, I was watching a road rage YouTube clip, and there was a guy. I didn't see what precipitated it that led up to it, but when the clip starts, the guy's front of his car was engaged in the back of the other guy's car, And the guy was like flooring it, just driving his car into the back of this car as hard as he can with his tire smoking and everything else. And then finally, one of the guys, there was another guy behind him, and he pulled out. So the guy took advantage of that to back up and take a run at the guy again and smashed into him. And he did this three times, take backing up and taking a run and smashing into the guy. And then he finally drove around him, but he clipped him on the way around and then drove off. So I don't know what caused all that, but this guy was pissed, and he was going to ram the hell out of that guy in front
of him. Was it a dash cam video?
Well, no, it was somebody standing on the sidewalk. Evidently, a crowd had gathered when this happened.
Oh, okay.
So somebody had taken a cell phone video from the side as this was taking place.
There were
several dashboard ones I saw, too.
Yeah, there's kind of a joke or a meme on the internet that basically all the dash cams are in Russia. Because it seems like all the accidents in Russia, everybody has a dash cam.
They have to, because there's no laws over there. It's just lawless. It's unbelievable. If you've ever watched those Russian videos over there, everybody drives, and it's like it's testosterone fueled. It's like you go to an intersection, it's a four-way intersection, and there's no stop signs, and there's no lights. It's everybody put the pedal to the metal and go.
Every man for himself.
If you're not a man, if you're not a man, if you hit the brakes,
yeah,
you got to keep it forward and just go. It's unbelievable. I've never seen so much wreckage and carnage in my life as those things.
One other exception to the contributory negligence is that if the plaintiff can show the defendant had a last clear chance to avoid the accident and did not do so, the defendant can still be held accountable even if the plaintiff is found contributory negligence. So that's called the last clear chance rule.
That's almost like you have to prove it was deliberate as opposed to an accident.
Yeah. Now, one thing is DC has slightly changed this now, so they're not a total pure contributory negligence state. They changed it so that they've moved to what's called a modified comparative fault rule for pedestrians and bikers and other non-motorized users like Segways and skateboards and things like that. Hmm. So if you're not non-motorized vehicle and you are found to be at fault, then it's not a bar. So, but it's a modified comparative, which I'm going to get into that and explain that here in a minute, what that is.
That's good, because I don't know what that is either. I missed on the other two. I flunked that test.
You basically have different kinds of these. You have the pure contributory negligence, pure comparative fault, and a modified comparative fault. So I'll get into explaining what those are. So,
all right. I look forward to it.
13 states recognize what's called the pure comparative fault rule, and that allows a damaged party to recover even if it's 99% at fault, although the recovery is reduced by the damaged party's degree of fault. Hmm. So basically, this is where the plaintiff is 99% at fault, and the defendant's only 1% at fault, but they can still recover.
Wow, that don't hardly seem right.
But their damages are reduced by that.
By that 99%?
By that 9%.
Oh, well, that would seem right then.
Yeah.
I will agree with the ruling, Your Honor.
Those states are Alaska, Arizona, California, Florida, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, New Mexico, New York, Rhode Island, South Dakota, and Washington. So there's a more than the pure contributory, but less than the modified comparative fault rule, which is the prevailing trend in the country and what we're going to get into now.
Okay.
So that leaves, if my math is correct, 33 states. And they recognize the modified comparative fault rule.
All right.
I'm over here counting my fingers right now.
That's good.
Took my shoes off, counted my toes too. So,
and you got 33 altogether with your fingers and toes? We need to have you examined.
I've been playing a lot of Fallout 76. So 12 states follow the 50% bar rule, meaning the damaged party cannot recover if it is 50% or more at fault. But if it is 49% or less fault, it can recover, although the recovery is reduced by its degree of fault.
Okay.
The 50% bar rule with modified comparative are Arkansas, Colorado, Georgia, Idaho, Kansas, Maine, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, Tennessee, Utah, and West Virginia.
Well, I figured we had to be in there if that was the remaining 33.
Well, these are the ones that follow the 50% rule.
Oh, just 50% rule.
Yeah, okay. There's 21 states that follow the 51% rule. So these are both modified comparative, but they're just different percentages. Under the 51% rule, a damaged party cannot recover if it is 51% or more at fault. So if the damaged party, however, the damaged party can recover if it's 50% or less at fault, but the recovery would be reduced by its degree of fault. So it's just 1% higher, basically.
All right. Now, who determines these percentages? Do you have to say, we believe that he was 51% at fault, or is the judge hand that out, or does a jury hear it and decide the percentage?
Well, basically, yeah, the jury or the whoever is the finder of fact or the trier of fact is the one who does that. If it's a bench trial, then the judge would do it. If it's a jury trial, then the jury would do it.
But you don't submit forth what you believe the percentage of blame should be as the plaintiff or the defendant?
Yeah, you would. In your closing arguments, you would probably surmise, if I was the defense counsel, I would say, you know, it was clear from the evidence presented here today that the plaintiff was at least 51% at fault for this accident based on the testimony of expert so-and-so who said that blah, 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 blah.
Well, so you would say it much more grander than that, yeah, to appeal to him, though.
And I would,
Your Honor, I would submit to you that this defendant is 51% to blame, at least 51%.
Well,
or my name isn't Jehoshaphat.
Usually you're talking to a jury, because in a case like this, you don't have bench trials. So you're talking to a jury, and it depends on what your own delivery is. The Jehoshaphat is not my character I like to play when I'm trying cases. No.
Well, that's grand. See, no. They listen to it and say, oh, we got to listen to old Jehoshaphat. He knows what he's talking about.
No,
I do. You hear that oratory he's given?
I do more of the Columbo. Now, it seems to me that...
I just got one more question. One more question.
No, I don't do the Columbo. I like to pretend like I'm up there teaching the
Most
jury.
Of our listeners probably don't know who Columbo is.
I like to pretend like I'm up there teaching and trying to instruct the jury and educate them on the case. And then whenever I'm doing my final closing, they'll have their jury form and their verdict form they'll take back with them. And I'll have that in my closing. A lot of times I'll say, you know, now when you go through your jury form here, and I'm holding up my piece of paper, wagging around. I like audible effects like that too. I'll say, you're going to go down here and you're going to see where it says, was the plaintiff more than 51% at fault? And you're going to check that box yes. And the reason you're going to check that box yes is because of the expert testimony from so-and-so, which showed this, that, that, blah, blah. So that's kind of how you would do that.
Okay. But I think sometimes Jehoshaphat would be more convincing.
Possibly. I don't know. I don't think that's my inner voice. That's not my inner monologue there. So just to break it down, to get back through and give you some more examples of the different kinds here.
All right.
Pure contributory negligence. If the jury finds the plaintiff was at least a bit negligent and contributed to the accident, the plaintiff gets nothing. So plaintiff's only 5% at fault, defendant 95% at fault. The plaintiff recovers nothing. Comparative negligence. If a jury finds the plaintiff is 5% at fault and defendant is 95% at fault, plaintiff would still be able to recover, but basically their $10,000 in damages would reduce by their 5% fault, so the plaintiff would only recover like $9,500.
I'd take that.
That's not a bad day's work.
Yeah.
Actually, it is. It's small.
After the lawyer takes his share, you get the $500.
Exactly. Again, comparative negligence jurisdiction, they differ. And if a plaintiff is found to be 50% at fault and a defendant 50% at fault, some comparative states would give the plaintiff allow the plaintiff to recover $5,000 from a $10,000 award, 50% of their damages, while other states would prevent them from recovering anything because they are equally at fault with the other driver.
So it had to be at least 51.
Exactly. Some argue that comparative negligence jurisdictions are unfair because a difference of 1% of fault is all it takes for a plaintiff to go from recovering half their damages to recovering nothing. But, you know, in theory, if you are more at fault than the other person, should you really recover anything is the whole question.
Well, no. If you were the one more at fault, you shouldn't recover anything.
So you fall on the 51% modified comparative spectrum.
Well, I guess so.
That's what you think is right.
Yes.
All right.
Well, I can already tell you right ahead of time, if I'm ever involved in a wreck, it's always the other person's fault.
Yeah. You always should definitely say that.
It is. I like the one where the guys, he ran into the guy and the guy got out. You okay? You okay? Yeah, I'm okay. I'm okay. Man, I'm sorry. That was all my fault. It was all my fault. I just wasn't paying attention. Here, you look shook up. Here, I got a flask here. Let me give you a drink of this. And then the guy takes a sip of it. And then when the cop shows up, he goes, smell his breath. He's been drinking. That's how you get out of them.
Yeah.
I always keep an emergency flask just for such an occasion.
I think I saw that in an episode of Law and Order.
Did you?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I did.
Well, I know a guy. I don't know a guy. I saw where a case where the guy had been involved in an accident, and they suspected he'd been drinking, but before they could test him, he went to his car and got a bottle of vodka out of it or whatever and just turned it up and drank it right in front of the cop.
Oh, that's what I said. So I saw that on Law and Order.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah.
I saw where that happened in real life. Of course, most of Law and Order stuff is taken right from the headlines. Their stories, I mean, they follow stuff going on.
That's what they tell you.
Yeah. And it's true.
Is that show still on?
Yeah.
I haven't watched Law and Order in years.
Law and Order SUV, we watch it, I guess it's Thursday nights, I think, at 10.
Law and Order SUV?
Yeah, isn't that what it is?
Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Oh.
Is that not it?
I think it's SVU.
Oh, well, what's the difference?
The V and the U.
Oh. Well, they're still in there. They're just in a different order.
That's right.
But what would you do in that case? Because you couldn't test him then because, yeah, he just drank a bottle of vodka right in front of you or whatever.
Well, you'd probably charge him with some sort of like tampering with evidence, I guess. I don't know.
It's my own body. I'll tamper with my own body if I want to.
And I would, please don't tamper with your own body.
You want to see what other kind of tampering I can do with my body?
No. This is a clean podcast.
Not only will we add drinking to your charges, sir, we'll add lewdness as well.
And lasciviousness as well.
Well, that's going to be a real problem because they're finding out that they're going to have problems with these self-driving cars. You're going to have more people having sex in their cars now because they don't have to pay attention to the road. So, you know.
Yeah.
That'll be a big problem coming up.
Well, it's gonna complicate things.
That's
for
right.
Sure. Now there's another theory, which is
it's like a mobile masturbatorium.
Now there's another theory which is kind of tied to comparative fault, and that is the theory of joint and several liability.
Joint and several.
Yeah, and. Basically,
so you smoked several joints and now you're liable.
So basically each tortfeasor / defendant is liable for the entire amount of the plaintiff's damages, regardless of their relative degree of fault or responsibility. So for example, say you sue three defendants and you obtain a judgment in a modified comparative. That's a lot of math. Let's not go down that road. Say you get a judgment, then the defendants are 100% at fault. So you get the full amount and your recovery is going to be $100,000. Mm-hmm. And there's three defendants. Mm-hmm. So basically each of the three defendants is equally responsible for that $100,000. So even if defendant one is found to be 10%, defendant two, 40%, and defendant three, 50%, it doesn't matter. They each equally are responsible for that $100,000.
So they each got to pay 33 to third?
Well,
or work it out between them?
Yeah, work it out between them. I mean, in theory, they each should do that, but it doesn't matter because they all have to basically pony up that $100,000 until they get it. And then
pony up, boys.
And then basically they would have to sort out through some sort of subrogation type issues between each other how to recover that from each other. So, but basically the theory is that we don't want the plaintiff to have to worry about trying to collect this. These defendants are all at fault. Let them pay. Let them sort out who owes it and in what percentages.
Go after the deep pockets.
Yeah, pretty much. So you can see now here where if you get a case, and I kind of alluded to it a second ago, where you have a plaintiff who is found to be in a modified comparative fault state, and they're found to be 20% at fault, mm-hmm. and you have multiple defendants, and each one is liable for different percentages of fault themselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can be pretty confusing.
Sure.
Trying to determine who owes what. And especially if you throw in joint and several liability, mm-hmm. you know, it complicates things.
Well, a lot of times, don't they try to grab somebody that is a deep pockets and throw them in the lawsuit and include them so that you can be sure that somebody can pay? Because if you sue like some little mom and pop organization or something like that, you may not ever get your money.
Yeah, the whole blood from a turnip.
Yeah, but if you can tie in for some reason, like if somebody hits you with their car and then you can pull in like the maker of the car maker or something like that. Because you say, you know, Ford vehicles have been known to do this, so, you know, or they did something that allowed them to do that.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely do that, and that's pretty much a good idea. I've advised clients before. I don't know what this person has. If you're going to sue them and not sue, like, if they don't have insurance and you're going to sue them, and they don't have a pot to urinate in, mm-hmm. so to speak, mm-hmm. then it's not worth filing the lawsuit.
Yeah.
So you usually have to do some sort of kind of
reconnaissance.
Yeah, there you go.
You have to hire a mole to go in and check their books.
Gumshoe.
See if they can pay it.
No, not a mole.
A private dick.
There you go.
As opposed to a public one. Or a pick of one.
So do you think you have a grasp on this this whole theory?
Well, I thought I knew what comparative and contributory was, but I didn't know that, so...
Yeah, but you understand. Who knows? You understand better now, right?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're aces.
Yeah. I know I want to be at least 49% innocent.
Now, what gave me the inspiration for this case, I was reading through the local news, and I came across a news story.
Yeah?
And I thought... this would be a good tie-in for this legal theory, which we had previously not discussed.
Well, I've probably read that story, too, because I read the paper every day.
I don't know if this was in the paper. This was on the WSAZ website.
Oh, well, I watched the news, so maybe I saw the news about
maybe it. Maybe you were. Well, it involves the largest city in West Virginia, or the largest city containing West Virginians in the summer.
Is that Myrtle Beach?
It is.
Really?
All West Virginians go to Myrtle Beach, in case you didn't know that.
Yeah, so, that's true.
You go down there and everybody's from West Virginia.
You run into people you know, and it's like, wow, I've run into five people that I know, and I'm this far away from home.
Yeah, you don't see them in town, but then you see them at the beach.
Yeah.
It's very odd. So so the story is basically, there were in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, there were two women from New York, and they have filed a lawsuit after breaking several bones on a slide at Broadway at the beach.
I've been to Broadway at the beach.
I have too. Actually, I used to live right by there as well when I worked there in the summers.
Yeah.
The two women, they were in Myrtle Beach on the weekend of April 29, 2017 for a friend's wedding, the lawsuit says. Following the wedding, the two women went to the Broadway at the beach. In the early morning hours of April 30, 2017, both women walked back to their hotel passing Pavilion Park Central, which was closed. Even though it was closed, the plaintiffs were easily able to move the unsecured gate at the entrance to the pipeline slide and climb the stairs to the top of the slide, claims the lawsuit. Without any employees present to instruct them, the plaintiffs were not aware that they needed to have the slide sprayed with water, nor did they know they needed a burlap sack to safely go down the slide.
Oh, I bet there's some skin loss getting ready to happen.
Without these safety precautions, the plaintiff slid down the slide at a very high velocity, colliding with the metal barrier at the bottom of the slide, lawsuit complains. As a result of the collision, both plaintiffs sustained significant injuries. Both women reportedly went to the Grand Strand Medical Center on April 30th, 2017, where they received medical attention to stabilize their injuries. They returned home and followed up with providers in New York for a full treatment of their injuries. One defendant sustained a broken right ankle, broken left ankle, and multiple fractures to her left tibia, which was required multiple surgeries to repair. The other defendant sustained a broken tibia, shattered knee plate, and two broken ankles. So, I mean, they have
substantial
serious
injuries.
Yeah.
Man, I'll say.
It says they both have extended recovery period due to their significant injuries, and surgeries are required to repair the injuries, and they've had missed time from work. Basically, what they're alleging is that defendants failed to secure the pipeline slide, knowing that patrons of Broadway at the beach would be passing through and have open access to at all hours of the day. Manufacturer and design of the slide, the person who built it, failed to install proper safety equipment to secure the slide when it was not in use. And so they're asking for actual consequential special damages, an award of punitive damages for costs and attorney's fees, and for other such relief the court deems appropriate.
Well, I would say 50% of the blame is yours because you were drunk, and the other 50% because you were trespassing. Case dismissed. That's what Judge Judy would say. Get out of here. You think I'm stupid?
We're gonna analyze the blame in this case using our newfound knowledge.
Okay.
So, do you think the plaintiffs were at fault here?
Yes, I think they were at fault.
All right. Well, South Carolina is a modified comparative negligence state, meaning plaintiff's negligence cannot exceed that of the defendant's. So 51% bars recovery.
Okay.
So the other issue we have going on here is multiple defendants.
Sure.
This lawsuit names BN Performance Rides, Amusements of Rochester, doing business as, or DBA, Powers Great American Midways, Burroughs and Chapin Company, Inc., the Pavilion Nostalgia Park, LLC, Broadway at the Beach, and Broadway's Amusement Rides, LLC. So you have all these different defendants in there.
And they all sound like they got money.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure they all do. You know, they're all these are basically tied to that attraction there.
Mm-hmm.
So BN Performance Rides, they're an Italian company. They're the ones that built the slide. Amusement Rides of Rochester, they're one of the ones who, I guess, basically imported probably the slide from the Italian manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
Powers Great American Midway, they owned and operated the pipeline slide.
Mm-hmm.
Burroughs and Chapin, they own and operate Broadway at the Beach.
Okay.
And then Pavilion Nostalgia Park, they operate amusement parks located within Broadway at the Beach, which the pipeline slide is at issue, is one of those rides.
Mm-hmm.
Broadway at the Beach, Inc., another layer there, they own and operate Broadway at the Beach, LLC.
Mm-hmm. Anyone that touches it, they got involved.
Right. So the issue you're going to have with this is how much are the plaintiffs at fault? Are they more than 51% at fault for doing this? And then also, if basically they're not barred from recovery by this modified comparative negligence rule, then you're going to have to assign blame to each of these different defendants.
Mm-hmm.
So South Carolina has joint and several liability. So basically, even if a defendant is found to be 1% liable, they're going to be on the hook for the entire amount. So if they can pass that first hurdle,
mm-hmm.
and then they can pass that second hurdle and get all the defendants to have at least 1% blame, then all the defendants have to satisfy the full amount.
Okay.
So that's the analysis of that case right there using what we just learned.
All right.
You follow it?
Yes.
Does it make sense?
Yes.
Now, without knowing any more of the evidence, I think they are idiots.
Yeah, I agree with that. How much of the blame do you get for being an idiot?
I don't know, but wow.
I mean, that's just ridiculous. It'd be like jumping off a cliff and then suing God because he put a cliff there.
Yeah.
And you jumped off of it.
Yeah. You know, in a case like this with the modified comparative negligence, I mean, I think it's a hard case to win. Now, if this was one of the pure comparative states.
Oh, we don't know how it's turned out yet.
Oh, no. This just happened.
Oh.
It was just filed. I mean, I'm looking at the complaint here, which was filed November 15th, 2018. So, I mean, this is fresh off the press.
Well, I can tell you this. From all those broken tibias and shattered knee plates and broken ankles and everything, those girls don't have a leg to stand on.
Ugh. And that's why this podcast keeps you coming back. But no, you know, you're probably right. Now, like I said, if this was a pure comparative negligence state, I would like this case a lot more. In Florida, this would be a great case because it's even if they're 99% at fault, you get that 1%, you're still going to recover. So,
do you know in Florida the other day they arrested a guy for having sex with a miniature horse?
Did they?
Yeah. But he said, well, I did it safely. I made sure I was using protection and I didn't hurt the animal. As if that was your 51% that made you not liable.
There's a 51% joke there that I'm not going there.
Well, I mean, at that point, he's all in.
There you go. Nail on the head. I thought that was actually a setup for a joke. That's why I was kind of waiting for the punchline.
No, I heard it on the radio today. They were talking about it. Poor miniature horse.
Well, now you didn't really know what we were talking about today. I just said try to find some cases where people did stupid stuff.
Yeah.
So I thought maybe you would talk about some of these cases where people did stupid stuff, and we'd look at them from the comparative negligence and contributory negligence and the joint and several liability we just learned about.
Well, like you say, I didn't really know what you meant, but I did look for stupid things. The problem was there are a lot of stupid things. I mean, I thought I was going to try to find a few. They just kept coming, and I couldn't decide which ones were stupider than the other ones. So we'll just go at it here as much as we can without running too long and see what ones are entertaining to talk about.
All right.
All right. Here is one where a bank robber, after receiving a pair of slugs while fleeing a police officer, this bank robber sued the county for $6.3 million. Said that he claims that the medical bills from the gunshot sounds equal to about $300,000 each, and that the police officers failed to stop the deputy from trying to execute him.
So now what?
He was trying to rob a bank.
Yeah.
And when the policeman approached him, he pulled out a gun on him.
Okay.
Well, the deputy pulled out his gun too, and he shot the guy twice. So now the guy's suing him
for shooting him. Hmm.
And he figures that that's worth about $6.3 million.
What state is that in? Do we know?
He's an inmate in Clallam Bay Correction Center in Snohomish County, but I don't know where that is. Sounds like it's somewhere in
Washington State, maybe.
Well, could be, or could be like Maine or something like that. That sounds like kind of like Maine names or something.
How do you spell it?
Clallam Bay, C-L-A-L-L-A-M.
Clallam Bay is in Washington.
You were right.
Yeah. I've traveled the Pacific Northwest.
You got your buddy Rich Greenwell out there.
He does live up there. Washington follows pure comparative fault. So basically that means that their negligence will be allocated by their own percentage portion. So basically, again, if
the guy is at least 1% then contributing to his own demise, he doesn't win anything, right?
Yeah. I think contributing is probably the wrong word to use because that makes it confusing with contributory negligence.
Oh.
But if they are...
1% at fault.
Yeah, 1% at fault.
Well, would you think robbing a bank and pointing a gun at a police officer probably qualifies as at least 1%?
I'm going to say they're 100% at fault for that. Now, I guess what you might try to look for in a case like that is if you were trying to sue the police department where the police officer discharged his firearm in some manner which he was not supposed to. Like if he was supposed to say, freeze, before shooting him. Like if that's like in the police officer's manual.
No, he didn't have to say that, I don't think.
Well, I'm just saying, for example.
I think when a guy pulls a gun on you, all bets are off. It's quick draw McGraw at that point. All right. Well, evidently, New York women like to file lawsuits because this was when two more New York women filed a $40 million lawsuit over about like five or six scratches that they received from a gas explosion that occurred several blocks away. Said that these two women, one of them was 23 and one of them 26, filed suit in the Bronx Supreme Court claiming they were severely injured both physically and mentally. But the New York Post reports that one of them said she got like five or six scratches when she went outside to inspect the blast site, and the other one didn't suffer any physical injuries, but did say she is seeing a $175 an hour psychologist to deal with the trauma. So what do you think? Do they have a case?
I don't know. I'm blown away by that fax.
Well, you were near the blast site, I guess, huh? You're within a few blocks of it.
You're in the zone of danger.
Well, what is New York then that they would come under for that?
Well, New York is a pure comparative fault state again. So basically, again, if they're 99% at fault, they still get their 1% recovery. So, yeah. So those are two states which actually have the most favorable comparative fault statutes for plaintiffs. So,
all right.
Maybe we're seeing a theme here.
Now this one comes from two Florida lawyers that evidently were friends.
Florida, pure comparative fault state again.
All right. The two lawyers, one of them 60 and one of them 76, and they contended they were friends. And when they met or when they saw each other at this one point, they shook hands. Well, the older one, the 76-year-old, says that I'm avoiding using their names is why I was doing it. The older one says that the other guy shook his hand so violently hard that it caused him recurring pain. And he also claims that this lawsuit might even have been avoided if his buddy had just apologized. He described it as the offending handshake was unexpected, unprovoked, uninvited, unauthorized, uncalled for, and most certainly negligent. That was how he described it in the complaint. So he's suing him for $100,000.
Seems reasonable. Evidently, Florida male attorneys like to sue people too.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. Let's see here. A woman from Wichita Falls, Texas, is suing the federal government after she alleged a bowling alley employee at Shepherd Air Force Base spilled hot nacho cheese on her finger. She claims that the cheesy injury resulted in restricted work hours and ultimately in her losing her job. The suit seeks $95,000 for her injury and damages. That's a lot of cheese.
I think that she was definitely at fault because she should have known better to order the cheddar.
Everybody knows you don't get bowling alley nachos.
Now that's an interesting issue too, because I don't know if this has been in a federal court or if it's in a state court or what, and that raises all kinds of different jurisdictional type issues in which law applies. I assume it's a federal court probably applying Texas law would be my guess, but I, without knowing the rest of the facts, it's hard to say.
I guess she's suing the federal government because it was at Shepherd Air Force Base, and that's, of course, a branch of the federal government.
Yeah.
Yeah. So figure it was their employees that did it, huh?
Yeah. I guess if they're running like a, you know, entertainment thing for the troops there, some sort of commissary, then
USO was in town.
USO was in town having one of their
hoopla.
Yeah, one of their hoopla bowling tournaments.
Now here's one that's kind of near and dear to my heart.
Trains?
No. Beer.
Beer. Close.
I like to drink beer while I'm driving trains.
Hence why you don't work for the railroad anymore.
What is that Grateful Dead song?
Driving that train.
High on cocaine. Casey Jones, you're going to... Or whatever. All right. a ridiculous lawsuit in the Aloha State. Kona Hawaiian-style beer is headquartered in Hawaii, but it brews its beer in other locations across the continental U.S. Now they are being sued for misleading consumers who claim they paid more for Kona's beer because they thought it was made in Hawaii. Kona beer sold in the mainland U.S. is brewed in Oregon and New Hampshire, which the brewery lists on the packaging. Guess the small print is too hard for some people to read. But instead of investing its resources back into making great beer, Kona will now spend time and money fighting this sudsy lawsuit, potentially leading to higher prices for craft beer consumers.
Yeah, I don't think that actually falls into negligence.
You don't think so?
No.
False advertising, huh?
Yeah, unfair trade practices. Yeah, probably not negligence.
But you know what that made me think of? You know what I learned last week that I didn't know?
What's that?
Do you know that Pabst Blue Ribbon has no breweries?
I did not know they didn't have any breweries. I knew that basically Miller did something like they bottled it or something and shipped it and everything for them.
They do everything. They make it.
Really?
Pabst Blue Ribbon is merely a recipe. Mm. And they have contracted with Miller Brewing all these years to make their beer. And Miller, because of craft beers, all the big ones, you know, Miller, Coors, Anheuser-Busch, they're all losing a lot of market share.
Yeah.
So they're closing breweries to make up for not needing as much production. So with them closing their production, they're told, Pabst, sorry, we don't have the room to make your beer anymore. And Pabst is saying, you can't put us out of business. If you don't make it, nobody else can.
Yeah.
You have to keep going. People want that PBR.
I knew they filed a lawsuit over it.
Yeah, that's what it's about.
Yeah.
They're making them do it. Natural Light, I think, and a couple others are under the same situation.
Well, that wouldn't be that much of a loss.
Nothing PBR wouldn't either, if you ask me.
Ooh, I like PBR. It's the only beer with a blue ribbon label on it.
Oh, it gives me the Hershey squirts. I can't drink that stuff. That's bad for you.
I like PBR. I do not like Natural Light. Although, I will say in my college days, I drank quite a few Natty Lights.
Well, that's with your red neck, your white socks, and blue ribbon beer. All right. Now, these frivolous claims are not only... in America, we also have them in other parts of the world. A Parisian man, that's a guy from Paris, claims his job made him suffer from crushing boredom and is now sticking that company with a big, not boring lawsuit. Frederick Desnard claims that the dull job caused him to suffer a bore-out that led to other significant health problems, including clinical depression and a car accident linked to an epileptic seizure. He's seeking €360,000 for his suffering and distress.
So, he's suing his employer?
Yeah, because he had a boring job. And the boring job caused him to have these other problems.
Caused him to have a car wreck?
Yeah.
That's
because it was linked to an epileptic seizure, and the epileptic seizure came about from the boredom from his job.
I'm not following that.
Well, that's what this guy claims, that this boredom in his job has caused him all these health problems.
It's all Greek to me, or French, as it were.
Yeah, it's French. Well, here's another beer one.
Oh, I like the beer lawsuits.
New York resident is suing Foster's Beer for deceiving him. Apparently, all of their ads featuring kangaroos and the Australian flags misled him to believe that his beloved beer was being brewed down under. In fact, Foster's is brewed in Fort Worth, Texas, and has been since 2011.
Sounds just like the other one.
So
with the Kona lawsuit.
Yeah. He doesn't like being misled like that. We should ask Leon Keith, why do you all brew your beer over here? Why don't you brew it in Australia where it's you say it's going to be?
I know from talking to Australians that I think Foster's is actually not very well liked in Australia.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
I think everybody in Australia drinks Victoria Bitter, VB.
Never heard of that one. But it doesn't sound good. That's not a good name.
VB?
Victoria Bitter?
Mm-hmm.
Well, VB, everybody might think it's VD. Would you like some VD? No!
No.
Keep that to yourself!
I might wet.
Go spreading that around.
I might wet my whistle.
All right, now this is a judge, and you've heard the old saying, "I'll sue your pants off." Well, a Washington D.C. judge took his pants to get dry cleaned at a family-owned business called Custom Cleaners. According to him, they never returned the correct pair of pants and betrayed the satisfaction guaranteed sign in their store. This served as enough reason to sue the business for $67 million for losing his pants, a.k.a. the most expensive pants in the history of pants.
I think the only way that happens is basically he had 66,999,000
in the pocket.
$999 in the pocket. And that really took me a lot of mental strain to come to that number.
Later on, he was gracious enough to drop the case down to only $54 million. Mm. Somehow he reassessed the value of the pants to $54 million instead of $67. So the lawsuit language has never sounded so beautiful as the offended pants man passionately describes his mental suffering, inconvenience, and discomfort at the hands of a business where never before in recorded history have a group of defendants engaged in such misleading and unfair business practices. So basically, life without pants has been hell. So Pearson continued his tirades, always referring to himself as "we" until the judge corrected him, in hopes he could get thousands of Americans who are subject to satisfaction guaranteed signs to stand up and fight for their rights for quality service. So he was hoping to make it a class action suit, see?
I don't know.
The case ended with the dry cleaner owner holding up a pair of pressed pants, facing the judge, the jury, and the plaintiff, and delivering the final blow to the case. "These are your pants," he said. Pearson ran out of the testimony, tears streaming down his face, shocked at such an injustice, and to this day, he denies that those are his pants.
That is an odd case.
Would you say this guy might have had some mental problems?
I think so. I don't think he should be on the bench.
I hope not. All right. Now, here's one that we have to blame on technology. Maybe Zuckerberg had something to do with it, although it's Google. He doesn't have anything to do with Google, does he?
I don't think so, no.
Okay. Well, technology has replaced all common sense and brain function, and especially if you were this particular woman. This story involves that she was trying to walk from 96 Daly Street in Park City, Utah, to 1710 Prospector Avenue, Park City, Utah, using Google Maps on her BlackBerry. Part of the Google directions she got involved was a half-mile walk down Deer Valley Drive. When she got there, she found that the road itself had no pedestrian pathway or sidewalks. Why? Because Deer Valley Drive was also known as Utah State Route 224.
Mm.
However, this lady continued following the directions and started walking right down a major highway with a lot of high-speeding cars. When she got hit by one, she sued Google for leading her there. She demands $100,000, claiming the directions were unreasonable and unsafe, despite the fact the road was obviously unfit for pedestrians and that upon the map, Google clearly marks Route 224 as a major thoroughfare. The lady also never saw the side roads she could have used, nor did she pay attention that Google posts a warning about the safety and reliability of its directions with every map search.
Now, I'll tell you there, that is a negligence case. Utah is a modified comparative fault state, and I think it's very foreseeable that Google, when they're programming their maps, because there's a little tab that you push for pedestrians, and it changes the route based on, it doesn't just take you the same route, whether you're walking or in a car or things like that. If you push the little pedestrian button and it keeps you on that same route where there's not a sidewalk, I think it's foreseeable that could cause somebody some harm like that. So I think that lawsuit, although at first impression maybe seems a little crazy, I think that's probably one of the better ones.
But what if she didn't push that button? What if she just put it in like she was driving?
I think she loses the argument as much.
Because I didn't know that. We just recently had that in Louisville. We were there for the Bourbon Trail tour. And from our hotel, we would Google map looking for somewhere to go.
Yeah.
And like it routed us out and around this one area where they had closed off the road for this plaza.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, if we were driving, we'd have to go out and around. But since we were walking, we could go right down the middle of the road, like, you know, straight ahead. So, but it kept routing us around that, and I had to keep assuring Mary, we can walk that way. We can't drive that way, but we can walk this way.
Did you push a little pedestrian button?
I never saw a pedestrian button. Of course, we were using her phone. See, I'm not very technically savvy, so I don't know. I mean,
I'm pulling out my phone.
I know
right
how
now.
To get my email, and I know how to look at Facebook, and I can answer the phone and occasionally send a text. But beyond that, those are about my four functions on the phone.
So I'm pulling out my phone right now to show you this. So if you look at the very top there, there's a little car on the far left. And then in the middle, there's a little pedestrian guy.
I see that, but I would not have known that's a button to push to see to walk.
Yeah.
I would have just thought it would show you the route and say, if you're driving, it's this far, and if you're walking, it's this far.
There's one over here on the far right, which is a bicycle. There's one on the...
I don't even own a bicycle. Why would I have that tab?
The funniest thing, it used to be...
I got a stationary bike, but that doesn't go very far.
If you put, for example, if you put like you want to get from, say, West Virginia to Hawaii, and you put walk, like it would, it used to say like you would like fly to San Francisco and then say rent a kayak.
Yeah.
They've changed that because somebody probably would actually try to do that.
And then they'd blame them, yeah. Just like this lady just, that just tried like to walk right down here. The middle of a highway.
Yeah, but no, you can change all those different little settings. So next time you're out bourbon trailing it, you should push that.
Now
push
I'll know that. I did not know that.
Yeah.
I just thought it was just giving you a time estimate.
No. But I could see, like, in that situation, if you change it and you rely on the fact, like, this is where you can walk, and you look at your phone, then...
It was like that episode of The Office when Michael Scott drove in the pond, because that's the way the map quest or Google map or whatever it was directed him. So, yeah. By God, he drove right in the pond.
I asked Jeeves, and this is what he said to do.
Yeah. All right, now this is my last one, and it's probably my favorite one. We probably know people that feel the same way as this one. In 1991... I guess it was that long ago, I can tell. There's a man named Richard Overton. He sued Anheuser-Busch, maker of beers like Budweiser and Bud Light.
Did he buy a beer and he found a mouse in it?
No, he did not. He sued them in light that their advertisements featuring guys scoring with beautiful women do not illustrate reality when consuming beer. That when you drink beer, it does not mean that you automatically get laid. He figured out that those ads were false.
Yeah.
His concern for the public seems to be pretty evident, as clause by clause, he accuses a beer maker of lying to society in order to get them to buy their products and promote the false belief that beer is necessary for social interaction between the sexes. This false belief is harmful to society, said the naturally funny at parties Samaritan. But then the lawsuit turns to its last page, where it claims the advertisements caused poor Overton emotional and physical distress, along with financial losses of $10,000. Sounds like a pretty personal case. So for compensation, he demanded $250 for every day Anheuser-Busch continued to air these ads.
That has no basis in reality.
Well, why?
Much it's, like the
it's
ads.
False. It's false. It's false. We've all drank beer. And you know, beautiful women don't come flocking to you when you drink beer.
They don't.
Remember the guy would be there at his pool, and he'd be by himself, and then he popped open a beer, and suddenly there were all these bikini-clad women all around his pool?
Oh, that was one of those ads a long time ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That never happened, did it? When we were teenagers and we would pop open a beer, it never happened.
The Swedish bikini team?
Yeah, or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that never happened. So... I don't know. I think the guy has a case. I'd like to support him. Unless you're allowed to do puffery. Do you think that was just a case of extreme puffery?
I'll tell you what. If you were a lawyer and you took that case.
Budweiser puffery?
If you were a lawyer and you took that case on contingency fee and you took just cases like that, you would not be in business very long.
You wouldn't be?
No.
Huh.
I would not take that case. I would not file that lawsuit. No, sir.
I'd like to take that case in front of Judge Judy.
The only thing I would take a case of is delicious Bud Light. You hear that, Bud Light? Sponsor us.
I couldn't drink Bud Light. I need something else. Sorry. Sponsor that half of the podcast. Don't sponsor this half. I just soon buy my own.
Well, I'm sure PBR is not going to come knock on our door now that you said it gives you Hershey squirts.
There's two beers we're not going to get. Well, too bad. I'm glad. I'll keep buying my own rather than drink either one of those.
I like PBR.
I wouldn't drink it on a bet.
It's downright tasty.
Downright tasty. It's downright nasty.
It's a good lawnmower beer.
Yeah, it's a lawnmower beer. You run over it with your lawnmower.
Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
So Legal Briefs is a part of the show where we have different legal terms that we talked about. I bet you can guess what these ones are going to be on, Tommy.
Yeah, they're going to be on beer.
What is contributory negligence?
Contributory negligence is the theory that you have to prove how much you didn't contribute to your own demise.
So let's talk numbers here.
That's where they do percentages that you were contributing to your own injury.
Okay. So say in a contributory negligence state, if I am the plaintiff and I sue the defendant and I'm suing you,
mm-hmm.
and the jury says that you are 99% at fault and I'm 1% at fault for the accident.
Mm-hmm.
In a contributory negligence state, do I recover anything?
Is it pure contributory?
A pure contributory negligence state.
Then you don't get anything.
That's right. Because even if I'm 1% fault,
and you don't get nothing.
You're 99% fault. I don't get anything.
But if it's modified.
Well, we didn't really talk. There's not really a modified contributory negligence thing. DC is the closest thing to that because they differentiate between pedestrians and people on bicycles and things like that. Because they're basically a contributory negligence state or province or district or whatever they are.
Mm-hmm.
But they've changed it now. So they follow a modified comparative for pedestrians.
Oh.
So what is comparative negligence then?
Well, comparative is that who has the most to do with it. That, like, you have to be, to win, you'd have to be at least, the other one would have to be at least 51. The defendant would have to be at least 51% to blame.
Oh, that's a modified comparative. I'm talking about a pure comparative.
Well, pure comparative?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then it's 50-50.
Nope. Pure comparative is basically
10-90.
Pure comparative.
199.
Pure comparative is that basically, yeah, 199. If the plaintiff is 99% at fault, but the defendant's 1% at fault, then you still recover that 1%.
Oh, okay.
So that's pure. So it's purely comparative.
So you recover, it's just a question of how much.
Yeah.
Based on the percentage of fault.
Yep. The modified comparative is one where if you're more at fault, then basically it's barred. And that's where you have the 50 and 51%. So if you are more, if as a plaintiff, if you're more at fault than the defendant, you don't recover anything. Basically, depending on that 50 and 51%. So,
well, whose fault is it that girls don't appear when you open that beer?
That guy who filed that lawsuit. Because he needs to basically close his eyes and dream about it or watch TV and watch commercials. That's as close as he's getting to it. Now, the last legal term. It's a tricky one. Joint and several liability.
Joint and several. Oh, that has to do with who you can sue and how they have to pay it. So, like, if it's joint and they're found that the ruling is against them, then they have to pay it. They have to pay it. It doesn't matter who was the most out of it.
Right. So, basically, in
like 10 or 20 or 30% and several defendants that were involved.
So, if you have three defendants, defendant A, defendant B, and defendant C, aptly named, mm-hmm. and defendant A is 15% and... Oh, man.
Now you got to do math.
I know. What? And defendant B is 35%, and defendant C is 50%. Then it doesn't
matter. That equals 100.
Yeah, if they're all jointly and several liable, then that means that
you're going to get paid. It doesn't matter.
They all have to pay say it's $100,000 judgment. They all have to pay the $100,000 judgment. If it's not joint and several liability, then basically defendant A would have to satisfy $15,000, defendant B $35,000, and defendant C $50,000.
Yes.
So, but joint and several liability means that they're all on the hook for all of it. And then basically it's up to them to sort out between amongst themselves who pays each other back, basically.
Mm.
So, yeah, well, that's, that is, negligence one step further. This is advanced negligence. Advanced negligence episode.
Well, I always like to find advanced negligence. I have some of that happens sometimes at work.
Well, do you think you have a better grasp on it now?
Yes.
Did you have any idea that any of that existed?
I've heard of the percentages before, but I couldn't have told you how it works.
Mm-hmm.
or that there'd be one where if they found you 1% contributing to your own accident, you wouldn't recover anything?
Yeah.
That's harsh.
We call that draconian.
That's harsh, my mellow. I would not like that.
No.
I would get mad. I would want to sue the pants off of somebody for $67 million for my pants.
I don't think you'd get anything.
Just empty pockets.
That's right. Neatly pressed empty pockets, but empty pockets nonetheless.
And he ran from the courtroom crying, saying, "Those are not my pants!"
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well, then not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out, though, right?
Usually. Good. This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf. And I...